What is, in your opinion, the problem with the language that is being used?
Well, there's a number, and I sound like the language police. One is feeding. I don't like feeding. Instead of talking about risk, I prefer to talk of potential adverse outcomes. Language matters.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 4 on Dysphagia Matters, evidence-based talks with Julia and Jule. Today, we are happy to welcome Sean O'Keefe.
Professor Sean O'Keefe is a consultant physician at the Department of Geriatric Medicine at the Galway University Hospital and an honorary professor at the National University of Ireland in Galway. His expertise is in the field of geriatric medicine, delirium, restless leg syndrome, and ethics. Welcome, Sean. We're really happy to have you in today's episode.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Would you mind starting our conversation with explaining what your relationship is with swallowing and swallowing disorders?
It was zero until a few years ago, essentially. It wasn't one of my interests, and I wandered into it, I guess, through an interest in ethics and my role as liaison geriatrician for elder abuse, of all things. And I can actually trace my interest back to a single patient where a former patient of mine had had a severe stroke, had gone home with a peg and a large package of care, and I was asked to see her because her husband was feeding her, was giving her food and fluid in small amounts for her pleasure. And everybody was enormously excited that this might do harm, and there was even talk about taking her into care or having the courts involved. And first of all, it made no sense to me because this was a devoted carer. No harm had come of it. And I couldn't understand how everybody was so vehement and certain about something. I'm not a vehement, certain person myself. I prefer to dwell on the uncertainties of life. And once I started reading it, I was astounded and said, there's no rationale for this. There's a disconnect between the evidence of benefit from avoiding oral intake and the certainty which everybody held it in enormous fear of something might go wrong. And that started, I started reading and then I started writing. So that's how come I'm here.
Wow, that is really interesting. And we are so glad that you are joining us today as our first guest outside of the area of speech and language therapy. I'm curious about your views on the topic as a physician. We invited you to this episode to discuss a paper that you have published in 2021. The title is Aspiration, Risk and Risk Feeding, a critique of the Royal College of Physicians' guidance on care of people with eating and drinking difficulties. Before we dive into this topic, could you quickly explain what the Royal College of Physicians RCP is? Maybe not everyone has heard of it yet.
Yeah, it's how higher medical education is organised in Britain and Ireland, and they go back to Royal Colleges set up in the 16th century. And even though we're a separate country now, we retain in Ireland the Royal College of Physicians of Ireland and the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. So they organise higher medical training and exams, and they're very influential bodies in terms of policy papers and developments. And the Royal College of Physicians in London is, I guess, the oldest of the colleges and a very influential and respected body. And the guide they produced is full of wisdom, basically, except where they went into this area where we felt that they'd got it wrong or got the nuance wrong. And we were very keen to say, well, hold on, because it's from the Royal College of Physicians, it'll be influential. And it's time to not attack it, but to try and nip some of the issues we saw as problematic and to comment on them quickly.
So one of the papers that were published in 2021 are called Supporting People Who Have Eating and Drinking Difficulties, a Guide to Practical Care and Clinical Assistance, particularly towards the end of life. This guidance updates the previous one, which was called Oral Feeding Difficulties and Dilemmas, published in 2010, which is quite a name for a guidance. And it was written by a working party of different specialists, physicians, nurses, dietitians, and speech and language therapists. Would you mind summarizing the RCP guidance?
Well, in general, a lot of the guidance is very sensible, particularly about things like trying to avoid PEG tubes whenever possible, particularly for people coming towards the end of life. The problem we had with that issue of risk feeding and related topics was the premise that if you have problems with eating and drinking and swallowing, then your problem and potential adverse outcomes like chest infections are as a result of eating and drinking, rather than essentially because you have the underlying condition of dysphagia. So it was that particular area that we were unhappy about the language, and unhappy about the, if you like, that it perpetuated this misperception of a linear relationship between dysphagia and pneumonia, between eating and drinking and pneumonia.
What were the main recommendations that they made in their guidance?
Well, it was because you're saying that eating and drinking itself is a major part of the problem, which we would challenge. It meant that there was enormous excitement if somebody was eating and drinking, and particularly if it was contrary to the advice of professionals. So there was a whole edifice of recommendations, including multidisciplinary meetings, a special type of jargon, such as eating and drinking at acknowledged risk, and indeed, in some cases, going to courts if professionals were unhappy with it. And we just felt this is the wrong emphasis, the wrong language, and the wrong practice that was being encouraged, rather than simply accepting people's decisions and trying to avoid the misperceptions that have arisen, that eating and drinking is the primary problem in people who get pneumonia.
So you have already mentioned the one of your first points that you make in your critique, that where you refer to the language use of risk feeding policies. So what is, in your opinion, the problem with the language that is being used?
Well, there's a number, and I sound like the language police, but it's something geriatricians are very attuned to, because it's funny how when you get dementia, walking becomes wandering. You know, there's all kinds of things like that. So there are a number of ones. One is feeding. I don't like feeding anyway. The feeding is for animals. Feeding is for the zoo. Babies may feed, but for adults, you eat and drink, even if you need some assistance to do so. The other is the word risk, and risk is a funny word because it has two meanings, if you think about it. We think of risk as danger, essentially. It's become bad, but we're also healthcare professionals, and we're interested in statistics and things, and risk is also a statement of frequency. We talk about relative risk, you know, so you mix up two things, and that's why instead of talking about risk, I prefer to talk of potential adverse outcomes, and anything you do in life has potential adverse outcomes. So putting them together in risk feeding is kind of compounding it. It's horror. The other one is to use an analogy, because SLTs are correctly deal with eating and drinking and swallowing. But if you think of your counterparts in physiotherapy, who encourage people to mobilize, and there's no end to this. We could go, if somebody walks and they might fall, you could call it risk walking. If somebody is prescribed warfarin, an anticoagulant, which may lead to bleeding, then you can start on risk taking of warfarin, at acknowledged risk of bleeding. So it's endless. And you say, hold on, why do you want a special jargon for this? And why do you want it to highlight one particular aspect, which is potential downside of an intervention? One might as well call nil by mouth risk non-feeding. You know, so as I say, language matters in terms of giving a steer, and it can lead us in the wrong direction. So I don't like the policy, but I also think the language matters.
Yeah, it definitely does. And I think, especially for us as speech and language therapies, it is really relevant. And I think we have lots of discussions about what language to use. And I think, or I feel like we actually do not discuss this at this point yet. So it is important that you're raising this awareness. So you have already suggested one terminology that you think is more suitable. What do you think changes if we use another terminology?
I just wonder about terminology, because another word for terminology is jargon. And we acquire jargon rather than, and I go back to the analogy of walking. So the physiotherapist suggests you use a stick. That's all. You now walk with a stick. So similarly, if you're at high risk of asphyxiation, then you need your food chopped up. That's all. Rather than having a cover-all jargon. The other one is about dichotomizing the problem of something going wrong. It's never about, and this goes to the other jargon I don't like, unsafe swallow, which is safe or unsafe swallow. As though this is something fixed. You're somebody with an unsafe swallow. Whereas any of us, if somebody gives me a massive dose of sedative and I'm drowsy and then I try and eat, well, I have an unsafe swallow right now. Something could go wrong very badly. So it's trying to put everything into a neat cubbyhole, when in fact a lot of situations change. As you know, there are times that are things that will make your swallowing much more likely to lead to adverse outcomes if you're sedated or if you're trying to eat too quickly or eat too much. But putting it in a box called unsafe swallow or risk feeding is something I find problematic. And it's not just for SLTs, it's for anything in medical practice or indeed in life.
The whole life comprises risks, right? So, and it's rather continuum than like it is black or white. So it's difficult to say at which point there is a risk, for example. But what do you think if I can even say that now in this way, what do you think is worth taking a risk and when is it worth it?
Oh, in regard to swallowing, eating and drinking is so basic that when you go into it, we did a study many years ago of giving people thickened fluids. I know we've had hashtags and we've had videos of it. They're horrible. So you say, well, even if it was more likely to lead to chest infections, and that's actually not clear at all, it's perfectly understandable if somebody say, I'm not living my life like this. I am not going to drink thickened fluids for the rest of my life. That is just so horrible, so destructive of my quality of life. Get lost with your advice. And essentially, it's like if I recommend a medication and somebody says, I feel awful taking that, I'm not taking it. I don't agonize over it. I say, sorry, I prescribed it in the first place. I didn't mean to make you feel awful. So it's back to respecting people's choices. And of course, to add insult to injury, as we say, the evidence of benefit from thickened fluids is next to none. Which means, again, why would anybody in the right mind take it unless they themselves, and I accept there are some people who prefer taking it because they like the better element of control. But it's not a matter of professional recommendation. It's always true shared decision-making. It has to incorporate people's preferences as to what their values and goals are, and in particular to respect quality of life as much as any putative benefit in terms of quantity of life.
I think that's a very important shift of perspective on this topic. And one of the main risks of concerns in the RCP guidance is unacceptable coughing. So out of your point of view, what is an unacceptable cough and who is defining this?
Well, that's the point, isn't it? I actually fully understand. I give people water to drink and I'm horrified when it sounds like they're drowning in it. It's an awful sound to hear. But basically, the unacceptability has to be to the person. And there's no denying dysphagia is a deeply unpleasant condition. But people themselves have to decide, does the pleasure of getting fluid and having my thirst quenched outweigh the problem of coughing and a choking sensation while taking it? So it's not for us to decide, it's for people themselves. And the idea that it's a professional says, sorry, that's unacceptable to me, therefore you can't have that consistency. No, that's the wrong way around. You feel enormous sympathy. And I know SLTs will give advice and say, look, you can minimize it by taking it this rate and doing it this way and being upright. So by all means, give all the advice. But when it comes to coughing and the choking sensation, it's the person has to decide the balance of benefit and the balance of adverse symptoms, such as that sensation.
I totally agree that patients should be included in this decision affecting their healthcare. What about patients who cannot give informed consent because they're cognitively not in the state to make that decision and might not fully comprehend the extent of it? Thinking of patients with dementia, for example, or delirious patients.
It's true, but they're well able to convey their personal preferences anyway. Now, I accept there's a problem sometimes with people whose dementia is so advanced that they've taken something to drink, they've suffered enormous distress while doing that, but then have forgotten 5 minutes later. So that's a problem, but that's actually a relatively small group. For a lot of people, as you well know, they can convey whether or not they like what you're giving them. And in fact, the main way of conveying it is by not taking it and by reducing their food and fluid intake, which itself is enormously problematic, or indeed by turning their face away or making a face. So even there, you have to respect preferences. And in fact, if you don't respect preferences, you lead to somebody reducing food and fluid intake. And that's one of the problems with all modified texture diets, both food and fluid, is the greater risk of underhydration and undernutrition. And as you well know, these are prevalent, particularly in residential care facilities. And it's miserable when you think of it, that people, for fear of fluid going down the wrong way, are permanently underhydrated, at risk of acute kidney injury, and often miserable. And they're there on a hot summer day, and they're not getting their thirst quenched because they're being given thickened fluids. I simply hate that thought.
What do you think about the statement, coughing is always a sign of aspiration?
Well, coughing is good, isn't it? We all cough sometimes. Something goes down the wrong way, you cough to protect your airway. So we're worse off without coughing than with coughing. So I don't see coughing itself as the enemy. I think that the metric has to be distress. And it's really, are we causing more distress by doing this or by doing that? We don't want to cause distress. People don't want to experience distress. And I think we stick with distress as the main metric, while accepting there are some people who experience both distress and pleasure from, say, taking clear fluids. And that's a tough one. It's a tough one for them. But distress rather than coughing. So it depends on how much they're coughing and how acceptable they find it. And it's back to a person or a patient-defined metric rather than one imposed by professionals.
And even if the patients can't express their distress verbally, we can still observe it.
Yeah, I'm certainly not laissez-faire in saying, you know, remember the old Coke ads where you turn back your head and you glug down 200 mils of Coke in the ads? That's certainly not going to be achievable as somebody who eats and drinks and swallows with difficulty. So you can do things by controlling the volume or recommending a control of volume for people who can understand that. But it's back to working with people rather than imposing jargon or indeed imposing our views. And particularly when imposing our views because we're nervous of being criticized as professionals, where basically it's covering our own posteriors is the main worry rather than what the person wants.
Yeah, and being afraid of being made responsible for something later on. But if we look at it this way, if we inform the person and give them the choice, it's not our responsibility anymore. Would you agree?
In that people have to take responsibility for their own choices. But the one is that our recommendations in the first place shouldn't be fundamentally risk averse. And again, I'll go back to the walking analogy. Walking is good. If you lose your mobility, it's disastrous. You actually end up worse in the long term. So the option isn't there of saying, well, you could fall, but it's your responsibility if you walk. You know, no. Similarly, eating and drinking is essential. So particularly this goes to people where tube feeding isn't an option. And this is one where crops up in people with advanced dementia, for example, where certainly there's a problem in North America and in the United States, but in general, for certainly Britain and Ireland, we don't recommend tube feeding in people with advanced dementia. It's never been shown to do anything. At which stage, if they've trouble eating and drinking, there's no plan B. the only way they'll get any nutrition hydration is orally. So we simply have to accept that and work with it. There's no point agonizing over will eating and drinking cause an adverse outcome. You say, well, if they don't eat and drink, they're dead. And so again, not to put it in a professional capacity of saying, well, I'm an SLT, for example, and my recommendation is nil by bout. And if somebody comes up and says, well, but they'll die, you say, well, that's my SLT recommendation. The rest of you deal with the outcomes, like they've no food, they've no fluid, their kidneys are shutting down. No, we can't do that. It has to be all recommendations taken in the broad as to what are the implications for kidney function and hydration, rather than simply what's the best way of keeping anything out of the lungs from a purely swallowing perspective.
Yeah, so it shouldn't be the question if they can eat and drink, but it should be the question how they can eat and drink the best, most comfortable way.
How we can, and that's why it's not an ethical dilemma, it may be a practical challenge, is how can we get the most food and fluid into this person in a way they'll find most pleasurable and least distressing? And when you put it that way, everything changes.
Yeah.
It becomes, which is, if I have somebody coming to the end of life, and even if they have trouble eating and drinking, I'm saying to them, well, I know how I want to go. I want to go like that patient I saw many years ago. I want to go on the red wine and high quality ice cream diet and the hell with it. And that is my usual recommendation, by the way. I'm not making that up.
Yeah, I really like that idea. And aspiration and aspiration pneumonia, two major aspects that SLTs learn to be aware of in dysphagia management. It is probably needless to say, but just to bring everyone to the same level. Aspiration is defined as material, either food, liquids, saliva, regurgitated upper gastrointestinal content, or any other kinds that has entered the airway below the vocal folds, thus is located in the trachea. Sean, would you mind explaining what pneumonia is and how the two, aspiration and pneumonia, are connected with one another?
Well, pneumonia generally means, the most common pneumonia is due to microorganisms. It's bugs getting into the lung. So if you think about it, most of us don't eat and drink infected material, but we've microorganisms living in our nasopharynx. We produce saliva, secretions, stuff from our sinuses, and we swallow that safely up to 1,000 times a day. And people with dysphagia don't. So it's not about the water going into your lungs, it's about the microorganisms slipping down there, which is why I think the focus needs to be enormously more on oral hygiene and oral care, because the whole term aspiration pneumonia is troublesome, because it becomes an easy label for anybody with dysphagia who gets pneumonia. It becomes aspiration pneumonia. And we don't know. We know they have pneumonia if they have inflammatory markers up, but we don't know what the mechanism is. And if you like, everybody's pneumonia is aspiration pneumonia, in that just about everybody's pneumonia results from microorganisms from the nasopharynx heading into the lungs. So it doesn't help. So it's been called an ambiguous term for a diagnosis of uncertainty. And so it's a label that's bandied around, rather than just saying it's pneumonia to have dysphagia. How can we minimize it? Well, starting position, I would say, is oral hygiene and meticulous care to things like that, rather than focusing on the water or the pea or the bit of broccoli, you know, unless you've actually taken that broccoli and shoveled it in the mud, it's probably not septic in some way. Now, nobody wants vegetable materials in their lungs as a matter of general principle, but we've got the focus wrong, and the label of aspiration pneumonia has led us in that direction, whereas the problem is actually microorganisms and particularly the dirty mouth. And it goes back to the Langmore paper in the late 90s, so that dysphagia is one, but it's not the strongest risk factor for pneumonia in older people. It doesn't cause infection of itself.
So going back to the language that we've already talked about, do you think it would be good to stop using the two together, aspiration and pneumonia?
Yeah, it would be so much better. Just call it pneumonia.
Okay.
Again, it's become a jargon that actively misleads and points people in the wrong direction. And aspiration pneumonia, and your patient has come into hospital from nursing home care with aspiration pneumonia, you're at fault in some way because you gave them water yesterday or you gave them something to eat. My God, what a bad person you are. You've caused aspiration pneumonia. And that's actually a whole burden of guilt and responsibility that isn't fair. And it actually leads people again to have fears for themselves and to think, I'm doing something wrong. We must avoid this at all costs. Nil by mouth. No. It's not helpful as language.
You also talk about pneumonitis in your paper. So what's the difference between the two?
Yeah, pneumonitis is chemical damage, and it actually is a big chunk of the problem in people with dysphagia. I guess the most, if you think of people being fasted before general anesthesia, one of the most feared complications of anesthesia is that when somebody is sedated and their lung unprotected, that they'll vomit and they'll end up with acid material in the lung. And that is very dangerous and very damaging. But it's distinct from our common pneumonia, which is due to microorganisms. So certainly a lot of gastric material getting into your lungs is damaging. And we've people who, for example, have reflux disease, where that happens chronically. But it's important not to mix up the two, because certainly you can be very clear about the link in somebody who has vomited while their conscious level was reduced and subsequently has severe acute respiratory disease. But it's aspiration pneumonitis and not aspiration pneumonia. So pneumonia, a term we often don't know. Aspiration pneumonitis, it's often very clear to make the link because it's very clear and temporal.
Great. Thank you so much for your explanation. You and your colleagues also discussed the terms unsafe to swallow and at high risk for aspiration in your paper. And you have already mentioned it before. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's often based on, or sometimes at least, on things like the penetration aspiration scale. It's great to have these scales, but in terms of labeling a particular degree of penetration or aspiration as being of itself dangerous, some of the stuff I find fascinating in recent years has been looking at ordinary people without any neurological disease, particularly older people, and the sheer number of them who aspirate at various times and deal with it. And so by having a kind of rigid cutoff and declaring this swallow is safe, this swallow is not safe, again, it's actually unhelpful and actively misleading. Because if you go by some of the work in healthy older people, particularly Butler and colleagues, you would say, well, actually, you'd end up labeling a large chunk of the older population as having an unsafe swallow if you subjected them all to video fluoroscopy or similar imaging. So we need to be very careful about that language, because again, if you look downstream, and I mean, if you say you're an SLT, but somebody goes to residential care facility with a label of unsafe swallow, well, what's a poor nurse in residential care going to make of that? My God, the SLTs have said the swallow is unsafe, and unsafe equals dangerous. My God, they're going to be terrified. And of course, they limit intake, which is problematic. So again, I prefer language to be precise, to saying, well, on this particular test, on this particular day, this happened. But we're saying, well, that doesn't mean tomorrow or the next day, or if we repeated the same test again, that would, because the reproducibility of the measures is not unlike many other medical tests, is not great. So we need to be very, very careful about labels, and labels that can mislead. And they can mislead not only other staff like medics or nurses who have no particular interest to swallow, but they can be misleading as well if people have dementia and courts have to make decisions, because a court is very unlikely to allow oral intake in somebody who has a dangerous swallow, as declared by this incredible test video fluoroscopy. My God, how could you possibly give them something to eat and drink in those circumstances? So I just think language, it comes back to language again, being unhelpful and misleading if it's very it's very directive in a way that isn't justified.
Yeah, and there's so much more that we have to consider besides the video fluoroscopic study or the fee study. So it's not just what we see, but also what the person wants, what their circumstances are, where they live, how they are cared for and everything else.
Yeah, and what their normal diet is, eating and drinking, is so many cultural factors, isn't it? I mean, yeah. I remember once somebody, and even I was a bit nervous, he had trouble eating and drinking and near choking. We were shoveling big chunks of pizza into his mouth, but he was of Italian extraction. Eating pizza mattered enormously to him. He wasn't going to accept pureed pizza. I mean, for God's sake, none of us would. Again, you had to work with him. Eating pizza was important. You try and encourage him, would you, for God's sake, cut it up into smaller chunks at least and not shovel it in like that. But you had to work with the person, you had to understand his cultural preferences and not just say, well, that's forbidden. That's, you know, adults don't take well to being told that's forbidden, which is why we're on the language front a lot of this talk, aren't we? Which is why I don't like the language either of compliance, which compliance suggests obedience. You know, it's doctor's orders or SLT orders. You're not obeying. You're a bad person. Even adherence has the same problem to an extent. Instead of people making choices, they listen to what you suggest and they filter it through their own goals and preferences and they decide what to do. And you accept that and you accept it in good faith and in good form.
Yeah, definitely. So here we have one other statement that we as SLTs oftentimes come across. Dysphagia leads to aspiration pneumonia. What do you think about that?
Again, it's back to this misperception that there's a straightforward relationship between aspiration and pneumonia. And the other implication is that interventions like nil by mouth or artificial nutrition hydration reduces the risk of pneumonia. And the evidence base simply isn't there. Nasogastric feeding increases aspiration. It's never been shown that peg feeding reduces the risk of subsequent pneumonia. So we need to be careful about acknowledging the limits of the evidence base. And it's not it's very hard to do randomized trials, but the only one in the territory of modified textures and diets goes back to the Robbins study.
The study is called Comparison of Two Interventions for Liquid Aspiration on Pneumonia Incidence and was published in 2008 by Joanne Robbins and colleagues. You can find the link to the study in the show notes.
And what happened there, and I appreciate they were using thicker fluids than one might now, but essentially once you started giving people so-called pudding consistencies, they got more pneumonia, longer lasting pneumonia. And that's often the question because particularly for thickened fluids, it may reduce the volume of aspirate. But I know what I'd rather aspirate if I'm going to aspirate something. I'd rather aspirate water than wallpaper paste. And again, the other fascinating papers in recent years has been belatedly doing animal research of saying what happens when you aspirate water thickened with the common thickeners. And certainly the results from the rats and rabbit studies, and we're not going to have a randomized trial in humans, has been they do much worse. They don't survive. They get more damage to the lungs if they actually aspirate thicker material. So there's so much we don't know. And again, that needs to influence the language with which we communicate with people, in that there's no grounds for communicating with certainty. It's one thing to say, you might try this, maybe this will feel better for you, maybe this will help. But saying things like, you must, we're absolutely certain, that's not justified. So again, we're back to language. If you're going to recommend something, you recommend tentatively in accordance with the evidence. And it is very much along the, you might want to try this, or we might give this a go. But if you don't like it, of course, I'll respect your decision not to take it anymore.
Yeah, but it's so difficult to say, I'm not sure, or we don't really know, but this is what we do know what we can do. So just to express the uncertainty verbally to a patient, I think it's really difficult for lots of clinicians.
Yeah, I just think that's something we have to get over.
Yeah,
it has to be. I'm perfectly happy saying you must take insulin to a type 1 diabetic. And I'm saying it on the absolute grounds of when I say you must, I mean you'd be a complete lunatic not to. You'll be dead in 2 weeks if you don't. That's what that's the level you need for you must. As a surgeon will say to somebody who's ruptured their appendix, you must have surgery or you're crazy, you'll die. You don't get that in SLT. The only equivalent in I can think of in people who eat and drink and swallow with difficulty is saying you must not shovel big chunks of steak into your mouth if you're somebody who's at high risk of choking and you've had previous episodes of near fatal choking. You're a lunatic if you do. You're Jesus Christ, stop that. You don't get to say that for other stuff. You really don't get to say that for puree or for thickened fluids. You're in a different level of evidence altogether. And I think that's important. It's not just for swallowing, it's across the board. If I'm suggesting a statin in somebody, I suggest a statin. And statins save life, except that, in fact, about 100 people have to take a statin for 5 years to save one life. Your individual chance of benefit is limited. If somebody won't take a statin, I don't agonize over it. I just say, okay, and that's not because I don't care. I simply recognize that the individual level of benefit as opposed to population benefit is relatively limited. So we have to tailor our language, and particularly the degree of certainty that we convey. It has to reflect the evidence. And for a lot of modified texture diets, including both fluids and diets, that's very limited, and our language should reflect that.
Speaking about the evidence that you've just mentioned, do you think that adverse pulmonary events should be investigated as an outcome in clinical trials?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the problems is, if you like, when you do, and it's cross-border, both clinical swallowing assessments and the instrumental assessments, is they're surrogate outcomes. You're saying, look, I've looked at you under video fluoroscopy, and you're aspirating clear fluids, and you're aspirating much less on grade 2 or whatever it is, thickened. That's fine. What does that mean? Don't know, because we've no evidence that that actually translates in the long term into adverse pulmonary outcomes. So yeah, it's staggering to think that there hasn't been further work, further randomized trials to follow up the Robbins work. There were flawed studies, but there were great studies, enormously hard to do, but they didn't exactly support the intervention with any kind of enthusiasm. And to say that if you want to keep recommending it, where's the planned follow-up trials? And the last time I looked, there were no registered trials. There's no plans for it. There's nothing in the pipeline, which is staggering when you think of the number of people who received, say, thickened fluids. And it's a massive, massive number in many different settings. And to leave it hanging without the evidence, you say, well, actually, that's not good enough, really. So no, proper trials, monitoring adverse outcomes, absolutely essential.
There's still a lot to do in this.
There is a lot to do.
But just to clarify, with swallow interventions, in this case, you mean modified texture diets, right?
Yeah.
So only the thickened fluids and modified textures, because there are, of course, other interventions for swallowing.
No, and I've no problem with other interventions at all, because it's the modified texture diet is often a long-term recommendation. It comes out of a hospital assessment and they'll go back into community or residential care. And I know we're short of SLTs. There's also the quite horrifying, in my view, studies, and we haven't got one from Ireland or Europe, but from North America, showing that when people can't get an assessment by a professional, what do they do? And the word is out there, thicker is better, thicker is safer. So that in if you're a nurse in the residential care facility and you have somebody who coughs a bit while eating and drinking, you're thinking, well, I can't get an assessment or I'll be months waiting for it. I'll put them on puree diet and thicken their fluids, without any guidance. And that's awful too, isn't it? That they're not getting any assessment. But I'm all in favour of all the other interventions, and an awful lot of it, you could say, is common sense about eating upright and taking your time. Except the common sense isn't all that common, so it's important advice. And similarly, I think some of the swallow rehabilitation stuff is excellent, and you know, all in favour of it. It is simply modified texture diet as an often quality of life diminishing intervention. And that's where one needs to be very careful about advising something that comes with harms and where the evidence of benefit is limited.
Yeah, thank you so much. Concluding, in your paper, you state the RCP guidance on risk feeding is likely to be influential and may be interpreted as an, quote, official, unquote, standard of care and encourage even more widespread adoption of risk feeding policies. We argue that the premises of the recommendations, in particular the lack of clarity regarding the nature, frequency, and severity of different risks, and the undue emphasis on aspiration as a risk and a potential cause of pneumonia, are flawed, and that the guidance promotes an unduly defensive approach to oral intake. What are your recommendations for clinicians working with patients with swallowing difficulties?
To accept, first of all, horrible condition, and to work with them. And I go back to the statement of, we want you to eat and drink as much as possible and have as much pleasure doing so, despite the problems imposed by dysphagia and underlying conditions. So I want them taken seriously. They really are. It's a horrible symptom, a horrible problem. And we need to be broader than modified texture diet is the answer to everything. And that means working together. I think that goes across the specialties, because I'm always astonished to find that the emphasis isn't given on oral care. And I know that's something that SLTs will emphasize, but it's getting across that actually, hold on, this is more important than obsessing about water going down the wrong way. It's also, and here I would be critical of medical care, in that we prescribe a whole bunch of medications without considering what impact it has on eating and drinking. So some of them are anorexigenic, and a large chunk of medications are anticholinergic. They dry out secretions. They make it harder to eat and drink properly, and they make it easier. A dry mouth is going to be a dirty mouth. So it's working, and it's one I would say to SLTs to shout at your medical colleagues and say, for God's sake, would you review that pile of 20 medications and see what there could be impacting on eating and drinking, and what could make it easier for my patient to eat and drink more easily. So I think it's working together across it with a focus on minimizing medication, maximizing oral intake, maximizing pleasure, and clarifying our goals of care very quickly as to where do we hope to achieve it. Because in somebody with a chronic progressive neurological condition, then swallowing is often only one of many problems. And clarifying, where are we going with this? A lot of people will be very clear to say, I want as much pleasure, I want as much quality of life as possible. Again, that's helpful in deciding where we go and how we get there.
Yeah, and the approach would differ so much in comparison to a young person post-stroke, for example, who has the potential to improve their functions.
Yeah, I think that's correct, in that there are different decision nodes, aren't there? Particularly in something like stroke. So I find it hard to get excited about anything be done in acute stroke, in that there's so much going on that if it turns out they're little by mouth, they're in an environment where their hydration, nutrition is going to be monitored and they can get fluids if necessary. But it becomes very different if somebody is after the acute phase and they're moving to rehabilitation. Well, then you're talking about a longer term. You're able to clarify the goals of care, and the prognosis is getting clearer. And again, you have a decision node if somebody is leaving rehabilitation and you're saying, here is the plan, and it may well be the plan for the rest of your life. At which stage you're saying, well, actually, you know, we've been giving you that ticking stuff, but we've no evidence that this actually will benefit you in the long term in terms of reduced chest infections. Here's the pros and cons. Do you want to accept it? Totally different. In the acute phase, you can do just about anything because, again, there's so much going on. The patient is in a poor condition to communicate and to receive information. It's very different when you move on into talking about long-term plans. So there are natural points where rediscussion has to occur about what the treatment will be. And it's particularly important if it's a long-term or potentially a long-term plan. And that's where I think, particularly when it comes to modified textured diets, we need to be very upfront about the lack of evidence and accepting absolutely people's preferences as to what they find acceptable, not acceptable. And indeed, one could say that if the evidence is lacking, should one be recommending thick and fluids at all, unless somebody actually prefers it because they get greater control?
Yeah, thank you so much. I think there are so many things that you have pointed out here that are really, really important for us to think about, to reflect on, and to implement in our clinical work.
Yeah, there's just one more I was going to say, Julia. It sounds like, God, doctor telling SLTs. As you know, we have a great gang. We're calling ourselves the Backlash Brigade in an email earlier today. But there's actually a sizable number of SLTs. As you know, a lot of publications in recent years challenging, if you like, how clinical practice has gone in that direction. So it's you probably know Paula Leslie and Tracy Glasenby Patterson, you know. So it's not just me. There actually is a chunk saying, hold on, where are we going? How do we get there? And I think that's a very positive development.
Yeah, definitely. And you didn't write the article all by yourself. So there were many other authors, including SLT. So definitely are aware of that. So is there anything else that you would like to add that we forgot to talk about in this episode? What is your take home or take to work message for clinicians, researchers, students listening?
Yeah, I think if there is somebody very ambitious there, the evidence base needs fixing. So proper randomized trial, it's the world is crying out for it. It's needed desperately. But the other one is about language and communication. And it's about, in particular, informed consent for any planned intervention. And I think there's actually a lot of things we don't know about routine clinical practice as to how it's done. So a lot of the basic information is lacking. So exciting times in terms of research. I also think that there's so much room for being truly multidisciplinary. And I mean by that across doctors and SLTs and nurses working together saying, how do we fix oral care? How do we optimize medications taking into account? So that there's a lot of ignorance and poor practice to be corrected. So I think exciting times in terms of improving things for our patients.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate that you took the time for us today. We hope that you, our listeners, enjoyed this episode. If you would like to get in touch with us and stay informed about upcoming episodes, you can follow us on Instagram at Dysphagia Matters, on Twitter at Dysphagia PCast, or visit our website at dysphagiamatters.org. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Sean, for coming on the show today. Take care, everyone.
Lovely to talk, and hopefully we meet sometime.
Yes, we would love to.
Bye.
Bye.